LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Tobias Churton, who joins us to discuss his book, Aleister Crowley, The Beast in Berlin, Art, Sex, and Magic in the Weimar Republic. Gnostic poet, writer, painter, and magician, Aleister Crowley arrived in Berlin on April 18, 1930. As prophet of his syncretic religion, Thelema, he wanted to be among the leaders of art and thought, and Berlin, the liberated future-gazing metropolis, wanted him. There he would live until his hurried departure on June 22, 1932, as Hitler was rapidly rising to power and the black curtain of intolerance came down upon the city. Known affectionately to his friends as the Beast, Crowley saw the closing lights of Berlin's artistic renaissance of the Weimar period, when Berlin played host to many of the world's most outstanding artists, filmmakers, writers, performers, composers, architects, philosophers, and many other luminaries of a glittering world soon to be trampled into the mud by the global bloodbath of World War II. Drawing on previously unpublished letters and diary material by Crowley, Churton examines Crowley's years in Berlin and his intense focus on his art, his work as a spy for British intelligence, his colourful love life and sex magic exploits, and his contacts with German theosophy, Freemasonry, and magical orders. He recounts the fates of Crowley's colleagues under the Nazis, as well as what happened to Crowley's lost art exhibition, 6 crates of paintings left behind in Germany as the Gestapo was closing in. Revealing the real Crowley long hidden from the historical record, Churton presents the Beast anew, in all his ambiguous and, for some, terrifying glory, at a blazing, seminal moment in the history of the world. Hello and welcome, Tobias, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hello.
Tobias, today we're going to be talking about your new book, which is called Aleister Crowley, The Beast in Berlin, Art, Sex, and Magic in the Weimar Republic. Before we get into that, tell listeners a little bit about your background and your work.
Right. I suppose I'd sum myself up by saying Britain's least celebrated genius of film, poetry, music, and books. My speciality is Western esotericism, which covers Hermetic philosophy, Gnosticism, the Gnostic Gospels, magic, occultism, Rosicrucianism, Hermeticism, alchemy. These sort of subjects of suppressed knowledge, generally discarded by scientism, those who think science is a belief system, and which I maintain because I believe in the spiritual freedom of the human being. And I've been beavering away at these wonderful minds for, oh goodness, how many, 35 years, with the conscious sort of mission, as it were, in mind. Yeah.
I would say it's such vital information to keep alive amongst humanity, but also I would say there's something of a revival and interest that's been going on for a while. Certainly I've spotted it. I first got interested in these matters in the 1980s. Things have moved on a great deal, and a lot of that's to do with the internet, of course. And there's pushback against this, naturally, from the Church of Science and all the rest of it and the establishment. But I think, you know, interest is growing.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope I've stimulated quite a lot of this over the years, actually, from behind the scenes, as it were, sometimes in front of the scenes. We do our best. I'm never terribly impressed by sort of periods where this subject becomes rather popular. You know, we had the Da Vinci Code, which sort of brought aspects to people's attention. My feeling is that the esoteric tribe, if you like, is always pretty much a constant through history. There's always a certain body of people. Now, obviously, with the internet, it might look like there are more people engaged in communicating about it. And I hope that's true. But it's never been a thing about numbers. It's more about a deeper influence, a bit like putting a dye in water. It only requires very high quality dye to have an enormous knock-on effect. But when we're talking about spiritual matters, which is what we're engaged in here, the benefits of any movement may not be visible for dozens of years or centuries, perhaps. Things get buried and come out again. It's very peculiar in that way. We're not after instantaneous effect. I mean, it's very nice if you're welcomed, but I think you should take it as a default if you work in this area that what you have to say will probably not be welcomed on the basis that you are going against the grain of the world, which favours immediacy, power over things, and getting it all done before you pop your clogs. And there isn't the kind of eternal perspective. You won't find that, certainly not in politics, which is the medium of power. And so they don't want to look at things under the eye of eternity. It's too big a concept for them.
Yes, no, I do. it's a very valid point you make. It's certainly not about numbers, and points been made more than once that, you know, as few as 5-10% of people changing their minds literally can change an entire society. But it isn't about timescale. I mean, the timescale I operate on at the very minimum is precession. nothing shorter than that. And I realize that my lifetime taken in that context might be significant, but not in terms of time.
I think it's nice to have a party now and again. You know, historically it's nice to have a party. We had a bit of a party in the 60s, didn't we? Didn't last very long, but it was a great party and everyone remembers it, and it keeps one's hopes up. But like all parties, you eventually come into the cold light of day and you know, we're back to the same old struggle with ourselves and with the nature of the world.
Yeah, well, as I said, if you're thinking on a huge time scale, on it, certainly from a human perspective, tens of thousands of years, that we're still quite close to a nadir in human affairs, that puts things in perspective as well. Especially when
some would say we're still under the shadow of the Dark Ages, and it's, you know, we've only cleared some of the forest up, which has made some very pleasant clearings that we've been living in various periods, but. I think when I look at 20th century history, I don't think the Dark Ages came up with anything on the scale that the Russian and German states managed to come up with in terms of destructive insanity. I certainly not a believer in eternal progress. I think it's one of the great fables of our times and our great-great-grandparents. It's something that developed in the 18th century out of astrological expectations and apocalypticism. But it's I don't think reality reflects the confidence that people like Professor Alex Cox talking about the universe and our place in it. And when I went to America the other year, I heard Hanks narrator a thing in the planetarium how we're all going to become citizens of the cosmos, and I thought, my God, we haven't become citizens of planet Earth yet. You know, I mean, what do we mean by these things? If this kind of optimism, it's nice, you know, it's part of the party spirit. Every party likes to generate mindless enthusiasm, but it is a bit mindless. I don't think we should be expecting sudden changes. I think it's more of the same, I think, is what we're in for.
No, I totally agree with you.
I remember an ancestor of mine called Dean Ing was known as the Gloomy Dean because in about 1900 he made a speech saying that the faith in progress, this was in about 1900, faith in progress was misplaced. Everyone seemed to think it was going to be glorious. And of course he was quite, as it turned out, quite right, because we're within just over a decade, we're headed for World War One and mass industrial suicide. So, you know, I'm only saying an old story. My kingdom is not of this world, as Jesus put it before Pilate.
Yeah, no, again, it's one of the main themes that I deal with here. It comes up again and again, whether it's someone I brought on specifically to talk about this or whether it just crops up with you like it has today. When people are living lives based on science as the only valid source of knowledge.
But it's easy, isn't it? I mean, yeah. any kid can understand science. I mean, if you've got a decent textbook, the Americans produce wonderful scientific textbooks. I don't think the English have ever come up with anything as good as they have. They do produce better scientists as a result. But it's basic stuff. Anyway, if you can see a thing, you can note it down, you can quantify it. Easy stuff. Not a problem for the mind at all. You know, any any scientist who's ever made a major discovery, you will always find penetrating it, that they didn't work it out on paper. They had an idea. It came from the mind. And that's what we're dealing with in esotericism. We're dealing with the nature of the mind. And science claims province over the mind, but it knows very little about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, nature of consciousness, we could talk about that for the rest of the day.
We could, and we wouldn't get anywhere.
No. It's interesting, though. Well, as we speak right now, it's the morning of November 28th, I think. I
don't terrestrially speaking.
I don't often look at the calendar, but today is what's known as Black Friday, of course. We think of the American shopping mall massacre. In terms of people's worldview, that kind of, to me, says a lot. It almost sums up a certain way of thinking about life in the world.
Grab it as cheaply as possible.
Yeah, get it now while you can, at any cost, because in a few years you'll be dead and then that's it.
What if we're not?
Well, exactly. We shall turn to your subject of your book, as mentioned earlier, Aleister Crowley. Relentlessly fascinating character, whatever you think about him. I'm just wondering, now you've also published a biography of the man.
I call it the biography.
The biography. Well, yeah, I have not read it, but I wasn't aware of it up until now, but I shall take care of that in short order. I think it's, my question was going to be, how did you get interested in Crowley? But I remember when I got interested in the occult, as I say, in the early to mid 80s, had Crowley books almost immediately, because as soon as you began to explore these areas, there he was, looming larger than life.
Well, Greg, I didn't get into Crowley through occultism. I got into Crowley because I was interested in mountaineering in my late teens. And when I went up to Oxford, one of the first clubs I took an interest in briefly was the Oxford Mountaineering Society. And it was at a meeting there where a friend was discussing Chris Bonington, the British mountaineer of great fame, who's one of his heroes was this man, Aleister Crowley. And I said, well, what's he do? And I was told about his amazing achievements in the Karakorams, close to the Himalayas, and other climbing exploits in Scotland and in Switzerland, and that he was also a poet and a magician. This sounds familiar territory. I was writing poetry on Mont Blanc during the summer, and I have felt a great spiritual urge. So I borrowed a book off a friend, The Confessions of Aleister Crowley, and loved it as a literary masterpiece and an exercise in communication of the mind. High-flown mind, very tuned into reality. He was not a fantasist, so many who enter this field are. And I was just very impressed by his mind and his sense of humour and his physical achievements, which were so reminiscent of men like Sir Richard Burton and British heroes who went off in search of the Nile or El Dorado or many other things during that great mixture of romanticism and industrialism in the 19th century. He just seemed a wonderful British oddball eccentric genius, and those are the kind of people who I'd like to spend time with.
Yes, he would have been an interesting character to hang out with. I mean, it's interesting the impression that I got, on perhaps unsurprisingly, at age 13 or whatever, picking up some of his books and reading a little bit about him, third-party accounts. I thought, well, this guy's, you know, he's some kind of Satanist, sacrificing babies in his up at Loch Ness and all the rest of it. And of course, it couldn't turn out to be further from the truth. Yes, he courted controversy, and he could be, you know, he definitely had a dark side, no question about that. You're no better than anyone. But just a man of contradictions and paradoxes.
Do you know, I hear this all the time, you know.
Oh, dear.
I'm a complex person and all that, you know. And a lot of it is just that the books and articles that are written about him reflect the complexity of people's reaction to him. And it's that where a lot of this mosaic complexity comes in. I found when I got to know his manuscripts, actually physically handling what he'd left behind in terms of notebooks, diaries, letters, I found a man who was continually consistent and had great clarity of thought and wasn't in some sort of personal war with his dark side anymore. You know, I wouldn't even say any more than anybody else. I'd say he dealt with a lot of that through projection consciously into taking the mick out the whole thing. I mean, this whole business about the beast and all that was his reaction to being brought up in a fundamentalist religious household. he was poking fun, with a sort of feeling also that, well, if this Christian era is going to come to a climax with the appearance of the beast, let that be me. And that's he was talking about initiating a new period of liberty and thought. And new liberties are always fought over. Fought, thought always goes together, doesn't it? People fight over what other people think. And he had a very free way of thinking about the world. And he unshackled himself from the terrors of the promise of heaven and hell that was being offered by a great deal of the Christianity that was purveyed in this country and in the United States and elsewhere in the 19th century. It wasn't an anti-God thing. He was very scientific about that sort of stuff. He was training, he'd done a lot of work in chemistry. He was very interested in, more interested in science than he ever was in theology, say. And no, I don't see an inconsistent person. I see a very consistent person with a consistent sense of humor that people just either get or don't get. When you think that his friends wrote to him as Dear 666, I think that gives you an idea of the level we should look at those personal projections. The fact that it upset a lot of people didn't bother him at all. He had a very aristocratic viewpoint. What ordinary people, I mean by that ordinary minds, make of this stuff was of no interest to him at all. He had a high work to do, any more than Michelangelo took notice when he was doing the Sistine Chapel of what was being put on, as it were, the cereal packets of his time. He was thinking bigger than that, really. Some people don't like that. They just think, oh, 666, pretentious bastard, you know. Fine, you don't like the personality, go and steer your own path. You're not compelled to like these people.
Okay, I feel like someone from the BBC now who hasn't done their research. He had a dark side, in as much as you're correct, we all do. Complex, perhaps, maybe that wasn't. He certainly had a complex.
What do you mean by dark side?
Do
you mean that we all have nightmares and are frightened of things? Do you mean by that? Or do you mean that somehow we've all got a criminal inside us who's dying to do illegal, nasty things?
Recesses of the mind, the soul, that perhaps sometimes, maybe often, maybe hardly ever, that we become aware of, that we sense, that we get a glimpse of, and we maybe like to say, that's not
well,
me.
Well, I think that comes, yeah, I think if we take the sort of Freudian model of consciousness, we're talking about suppressed desires. Well, the thing about Crowley was he didn't suppress his desires, you see. So there wasn't a lot of dark corners left in his mind. He'd got it all out. He let it hang out, as it were. And he got all that out into the open and of his own mind. And I think that's what the Beast 666 is partly about, isn't it? Who is the beast? It's man, of course. Man is the beast. Man is the barely trained jungle creature, you know, who flirts with civilized values only to disappear back into an orgy of war and self-loathing. And, you know, who was a German writer, wasn't it? Wrote a book called Das Untier in about 1983, which translates as the man beast. And it was a book of philosophy in Germany. And he was saying, this is man. He will produce the Holocaust. It's his fundamental. And no matter how much he tries to break away from his nature, he's still mentally unable to cope with the demands of the time. And he will sink back into reactions of violence and destruction. I mean, this, as a friend of mine in Germany said, he's an idealist, the writer of this book, you know, to think he has a theory which covers all facets. Crowley was definitely working on the beast of himself, if you like. But this idea of the dark side is too close in people's imagination to horror movies and ghost stories and all that stuff. You know, it's Crowley, to read his papers, is very clear. You never get sort of psychopathic feeling or the sense of somebody who's on the edge of breakdown or what have you. You know, you just don't get this. You know, in some ways, he almost, I think John Simon said he lacked imagination. I don't think that's true, but I think he wasn't this kind of jumbled up fantasist that people imagine at all. The common image of him is really wrong. I mean, I can't put it. That's why I wrote the biography, to give him his voice, because that was the voice that hadn't been heard. And the new book is particularizes that to his amazing time in Berlin, which has not been written about in any depth before, and is all new research, nearly all new research and new material. There will be obsessives out there, of course. Now, I read this. Somebody sent me a mimeograph from California, and they may have read this bit or that bit. You know, it's a bit like collecting LPs. The Crowley freaks do tend to be a bit like Hendrix or Beatles obsessives. You know, they've got to have everything, and they think they've got everything when they've got something. But this is my view of it, obviously. And I think Crowley was an interesting libertarian, romantic philosopher.
Well, you're absolutely right to make a general point about phrases like dark side. It's bandied about. I mean, it's Star Wars now, isn't it? Basically, commentators, writers, people in the media, these stock phrases come up and everybody's maybe got an idea about what they mean about it. And I think you're right. You have to sometimes be more rigorous about it. And, you know, as you asked me, what do you mean by that? And not just let it go, because sometimes it doesn't serve the, you know, the discussion or the debate.
I think Crowley saw the ludicrous character of the black magic imagery and would play with it to a very limited degree. But he was amazed anyone could be so foolish as to mess around with electricity, you know, without rubber gloves, as it were.
Well, it's you mentioned this, the book again is concentrating on his couple of years or so spent in Berlin in the early 30s. Now, obviously, that's a city that you spent time in. In this interwar period, obviously, Germany came out of World War One in poor shape physically and financially. But by the time we get into the 30s, how would we characterize the Berlin of that time?
On the edge of a precipice, the nature of which it couldn't see. Indeed, could anybody really see where it was going to end up? There were definite hints and people had got ideas, but it was on the edge of the precipice. But it was also at the same time, miraculously, Berlin was a crucible of modernism, change and freedom. Very odd. When I first went to Berlin, there must be something about the place. When I went there in the early 80s and it was still surrounded by tank traps and tanks and machine guns and electric fences and all of that. And it was the most militarized city in the world. And yet I never felt freer than I was in Berlin. And a lot of people with a free spirit centered on the place. I say a lot of Germans getting away from the tedious conservatism and repressiveness of a lot of the German economic miracle. People are escaping from the economic miracle, trying to find something inwardly satisfying. Went to Berlin. Crowley's Berlin in the 30s had a certain similarity insofar as there was an amazing atmosphere of liberty. I've seen a bit of film of Buster Keaton, the old silent genius silent cinema, with him standing, having just arrived in Berlin in about 1928, thereabouts, and he's gazing around him at the overhead trains that were so futuristic, you know, inspired the film Metropolis, Fritz Lang's famous movie. And he's looking around almost like he's landed on another planet. And I think Berlin in 1930 is like a city from another planet. There are things happening there that just aren't happening anywhere else. Artistically, intellectually, in filmmaking, cinema was so advanced. Hitchcock went to Berlin to understand what was going on in German cinema. And Berlin for Hitchcock was what Hamburg was for the Beatles. It was the crucible experience that turned them into and also ran into a bright, shining star. Crowley wanted to be there because it was where the most exciting minds of the time were. And he knew some of them. Einstein was living in a flat in Berlin at the time. Schrödinger, famous for the quantum cat experiment. You had some of the greatest writers, Bertolt Brecht, some of the greatest theatrical people, Max Reinhardt, in painting, you had Nolte, and you had Rotluff, and it was just a ferment. You also had this amazingly burgeoning new gay scene where you could be a transsexual, you could be a homosexual, you could manifest, as Krista Isherwood, of course, the English gay crowd were sort of leaving Cambridge and going off to Berlin because they could do what they wanted without having to serve hard labour in the Oscar Wilde sense. There was an Institute of Sexology which advocated public sex education. There were modern things in the streets that were visible, technological advances, amazing architecture you've got the Bauhaus movement. Gosh, you know, what a place. And this amazing renaissance of archetypal modernism, so in advance, Crowley goes there and they like him. They get the message. They see the something about this guy, so unlike other English people. He gets the interest of Karl Nierendorf, one of the greatest modern art promoters of the time. And he takes an interest in Crowley. He says, you know, he's so unlike the English tend to paint insipid copies of French movements. This guy's a force of his own. He paints like himself. It's vital. He could see the connection between Crowley's art and expressionist and abstract painters that he was familiar with. And Crowley was the only English artist to have his own exhibition in Berlin in this period, the only one. They weren't interested in the other guys that we were offering. There were people who did international exhibitions and came as a group of English artists. Crowley was the one who got the exhibition, and it was at its time a shocking and thought-provoking exhibition of about 73 original paintings and drawings, mostly paintings. And whereas in England, he couldn't get at a gallery he would show his work, because they thought, you know, if they put a Crowley picture up, you know, the house will fall down because, you know, Satan will visit or something like this. So the Germans, being a bit more intelligent than the average superstitious English bod, who Crowley was happy to outrage that sort of pomposity that was so prevalent in Britain's imperial twilight. And Germany liked him. He liked Germany. He lived there in abject poverty. I mean, terrible. I mean, he never begged, but he was perennially broke. How he survived is a miracle. Perhaps some of his sex magic paid off with a few coins. But if you used his income as a measure of his sexual magic skills, you'd have to say he wasn't very good at it. He made his mark on the place, and it was only lack of investment and the terrible economic conditions which Berlin and whole Germany were suffering at the time, and a constant degrading of the German currency, it should have worked had it not been. I mean, he had to leave eventually because of the Hitler thing. They knew about him. They suspected he was a spy, and had they got any more than a suspicion, he would have, as he said in a letter to his friend in England, you'd have to make an appointment for me with the embalmers. So he got out just in time, because the new chancellor in 1932 had been familiar with Crowley's activity as an anti-German spy in New York in the First World War. So many dimensions to Crowley's time there. Art is part of it, politics is part of it, spying is part of it, sex magic is part of it. But generally, being a revolutionary spiritual, they were looking for a spiritual revolution in Berlin, and then they almost got one.
Yeah, well, you touch upon this as well in the book, and it's absolutely fascinating how Germanic consciousness had changed over centuries, but particularly it was changed by the war and what the country underwent during that time. And of course, it happened again with World War II. But to me, that's very, very interesting, because today we say German, you think of, you know, towels on beaches. Mm-hmm. You think of Basil Fawlty and his run-in with the Germans. You think ruthless efficiency, whether it's blowing things up or building cars. You've got all these terrible cliches about Germans, you know, Germany and German people. Mm. And yet you have this, well, you can put it into words better than I, but it's this sort of romantic streak that goes back that's sort of been smothered at various times in history.
Yes, they've become afraid of it now because they've been told that the reason Hitler gained a foothold was because of an embrace of irrational thought. So reason, enlightenment reason, rationalism has become the saving the apparent or alleged saving principle and philosophy of modern Germany. So as long as they stick, you know, they're a bit like an alcoholic, you know, as long as they attend rational classes, a bit like the AAA regularly, it'll keep them off the hooch that sent them barmy. And part of the hooch that sent the barmy was German romanticism, you see, because it also, according to the myth that was put about very much in the 50s and 60s, German romanticism was a very dangerous thing, and it led to the kind of fantasism that would eventually, with a few twists here and there by Adolf and his mates, would turn out into the sort of the Götterdämmerung of the 1940s. I think this is a great error, a profound error. Germany's romantic heritage does not explain away or explain the Nazi catastrophe by any means. And many of these romantic philosophers and so forth were Jews as well. Anyway, so you'd have to say that, if you start talking these generalities, you end up with ridiculous polar opposites that don't match, you know, that are unreal polarities. So, Germany had a conception that the spiritual world should be accessible to reason, that it had. Because of the influence of theosophy coming out of the 17th and 18th centuries. So they had a more vivid sense of spiritual reality. Whereas in England, we're moving from a kind of indifferentism to the positivist notion that, well, I'll believe it when the man in the white coat tells me it's safe, you know, which is what we have today.
Yes.
And the government co-opts men in white coats to tell us what is and isn't safe and so forth. And the newspapers are happy to go along with it because it's the easy option, isn't it? So problems of the mind end up in loony bins, and everyone else must be on the job market wagon because that's where reality is.
Yeah, I mean, we talked at the top of the hour about the ruin that was the First World War, perhaps the first great devastating consequence of the...
Yeah, the Western mind has been utterly traumatized by these wars.
And it's scientific materialism that brought us there, basically. It's interesting that in the interwar period that you had...
You're absolutely right. These, never let it be forgotten. These were scientific wars, you know, from chlorine gas to high explosives. These were the miracles of science which were spread over the soft flesh of young men from around Europe.
Yeah, I did a show recently about the Surrealist movement and how much that was informed by, you know, directly by World War One, you know, because, you know, they were reeling against positivism. And,
unfortunately, the reaction went too far and they rejected what had gone before the war as well. So for example, I'm very keen on the Edwardian period, for example, for many reasons, but Crowley was very much part of that. That was his heyday as a publisher, as a writer, as a poet, as an activist in English society. It was the Edwardian period. But in fact, that period's been almost completely lost to us, to our perception. Even in art, they tend to go, they jump from Impressionism to Surrealism. You know, one mighty leap, which happens to leap over much of the 1890s, the 1910s, and the very, very interesting artistic and philosophical movements of that period, which I'm trying to put right now with the Berlin book, and I'm going to do another one on Paris in due course, I think, and the role of art in these fields. I think this is a very fecund area. Your history of art that you're going to be taught if you study art is very light on the spiritual background to these great artists of the modern era.
You mentioned Paris. Just while I remember, I noticed a documentary the other day, but I've not seen it. Maybe you have. It's called Legendary Sin Cities, Paris, Berlin and Shanghai. Does that ring a bell?
No.
Oh, okay, well, something to check out then.
See, they still do it, don't they? This is the kind of thing, legendary sin cities, you know. Ooh, it's Sunday newspaper stuff. It's legendary sin, Paris, the place of sin. It's all the mentality of sex is evil, that they just play on to sell their superficial view of history, which is sex equals sin. This is what the whole movement was trying to get away from, but it sells, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah, of course. And if you were marketing that DVD, then you'd probably think, yeah, that sounds about right. But, well, you mentioned
marketing rather than truth.
Yeah, exactly. And again, we're not seeing the documentary, but let's assume that as a numbers.
Well, I'm not talking about the documentary. I'm talking about the typology, the mode of thinking.
Oh, yeah, of course. And that's probably an example of it. But you mentioned Crowley living in abject poverty at his time in Berlin. He obviously came from a fairly wealthy family. And I must admit, this was news to me that he'd struggled with money at quite often, actually, but certainly during this time. Because I'd always...
Well, he'd been effectively broke from about 1914.
Yeah.
So, you know, broke-ish, but hovering around. He had a small amount of income up to the First World War from renting out his place at Beleskin, but that money was stolen by a man called Macney Cowie, who was a Scottish... he was supposed to be his financial agent in England.
Mm.
But he sold all Crowley's stuff off while Crowley was in the United States. When he came back to England in 1919, he had nothing.
Yeah, because, of course, that gets a popular view. I assumed that, because of his background, that he would never struggle for money. But then I began to wonder about his book sales. I don't know if there was any sort of misappropriation of funds there as well. But I just wondered what his book sales were like. As they were appearing, you know, was he basically selling almost none, or did he have a decent income from that up to a point? And when he was in Berlin, were his books all still in print? You know, it's just something.
I think it's very difficult for people today to understand the economics of being an artist in that period, 1900 onwards. You could live as an artist in the Western world if you had the class to attend places where drinking took place and conversation. You could still be a figure in the cultural world, even if you went back to a very small room and were on very little diet. First of all, you would needed friends who would buy you decent dinner occasionally, who would lend you a pound. And if you came up with a few bob from having sold some of your books to a collector, Crowley mostly sold his books to collectors. Bookshops in England would not take his books. Even when he had a decent publishing arrangement in the late 20s with Mandrake Press in London, the salesmen went round to the shops. They would not put Crowley on the shelves unless it was as a kind of scurrilous, you know, like this banned book or something like that. So Crowley stuff was always under the counter and appealed to collectors, because the books that he produced himself particularly and paid for himself had beautiful bindings and wonderful printing, because he was very much inspired by the William Morris notion of the book beautiful. And he got over that later, especially when he could no longer afford it. But his idea of a book was something which would last millennia, you know, survive the Holocaust. And so, no, he didn't get income from books in the way that many people imagine authors do. Actually, I'll be honest with you, it ain't much different now, except the cost of living for a writer is now, it makes it almost impossible to be a writer in the old sense. I can't go to Soho and find myself a garret room and pay five bob a month. You know, it's just, you know, you've got it. There's a Russian oligarch's kid living in there, paying £100,000 a month or something. You know, this is so. It was easier to be an artist in those days if you came from the right background, but you didn't have much money. So you could just about live a sort of gypsy hand to mouth existence. But many have said, how the hell did Crowley survive? You know, was it the magic? Well, I think the magic may have generated a certain amount of flow in his direction. But I think somebody once said he lived on involuntary contributions of his friends after his break. But I noticed there was a local aristocrat around here who lost everything due to death duties and whatnot. And I noticed they were still living in the house quite a long time after. And I say, so if you've got friends who think you shouldn't die or go on the streets, then, you know, if you've got friends, you can just about survive. Crowley was prepared to go without necessities. But in the period we're talking about, in the early 30s, he had a follower in Germany called Karl Germer. And Germer's American wife, his second wife, Cora, financed Crowley with a loan to some extent, which went to a certain end. She spent ages trying to get the money back, and he spent ages trying to make money out of his publishing to pay her back. And there were very, and a lot of his time in Germany was spent with trying to get cash generating projects going. But of course, Germany was in a financial depression at the time. It was very, very hard. The whole point about the art exhibition, from his point of view, was to create an advertisement for his books, because his autobiography, or auto-hagiography, as he amusingly called it, had just been published in England, and they wanted to get a German version out and also sell his book on magic in theory and practice. And he was trying very, very, very hard to get noticed, and he went round to Ulsteins, the big publishers, and tried to get a deal for short stories. Very nearly brought it off, you know. Crowley had terrible luck. For an alleged Satanist who might have had the devil doesn't have bad luck, you know. When Lee Harvey Oswald pulls the trigger, poor President Kennedy, you know, if it had been... Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
when
yeah,
it comes
yeah.
to shooting John Lennon, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, President Kennedy, etc., etc., somehow the devil never misses. Now, if Crowley was indeed the servant of Satan, consciously or otherwise, he'd have had a far better time of it, at least up to a point when the inevitable alleged disaster must befall him. But he didn't. He lived. He struggled hard in a world that didn't want to know about magicians and the nobility of man's spiritual liberty.
That concludes part one of our interview. Be sure to tune in next week for part two. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is legalizefreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were 7 UK pounds, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.